Welcome once again to our history of the Catholic Church in the United States, this time during the era of the New Deal, during those lengthy years of the presidency of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. You may recall that in our last episode, we were talking about the progressive years in American history, the first two decades of the 20th century, and the flurry of progressive legislation that was passed to try to alleviate many of the social ills in America. Well, we're going to start talking in this episode about the same kind of thing. We're going to start talking about a flurry of legislation. Once again, it would be done very quickly, and it would be done with great urgency. And the reason it was done with great urgency is not simply to overcome social ills. The reason it was done with great urgency is because there was a very significant economic condition that existed in the United States, and that condition had come down to us from the Depression in 1929. So it was a flurry of legislation to alleviate an urgent economic distress. That's what the early New Deal was all about. And we want to look at the Catholic Church now in this period of time that we call the New Deal. In those years, in the early 30s, there were 13 million unemployed people in this country. Many, many Catholics were standing in bread lines. Others were selling apples on street corners. Still others were standing by WPA bonfires at public works camps. Many, many Catholics were very seriously and very adversely affected by the Depression. And when we start talking about these years, before we even think about the national level, one of the great places to keep in mind is New York City, St. Francis Friary on West 31st Street. They began their bread line in the late 20s, and that bread line is still going to this day. It is the oldest bread line in the country. It was for many years the longest. It may still be the longest. But the Franciscan Friars on West 31st Street in New York began their bread line during the Depression, and they are still keeping that up today. So many Catholics then were very adversely affected economically by the Depression, and they looked forward to what the Roosevelt administration was going to do for them. There were some Catholics, of course, who were amassing a fortune during these years, becoming very rich and very wealthy, very influential. But these people would not have been in the majority. Most Catholics were probably on the lower echelon of the economic level. During these years in the early 30s, we have a period that is quite interesting to us in United States Catholic history, and it was discussed at some length by Jesuit Father James Hennessy, one of the leading U.S. Catholic historical scholars, in a very fine survey book that he wrote some years ago called American Catholics. He devotes a chapter of his book to the New Deal years, and he titles that chapter, We Shall Not Wither Up and Blow Away. Now, by that chapter title, the point Father Hennessy is trying to make is that United States Catholics in this particular period of our history were searching, they were groping for some kind of a unifying, integrating principle on which to build their own unique vision of America. That was hard to do, of course, when economically things were not going so well. But as things got better, as the policies of the Roosevelt administration seemed to improve the life of many of these economically downtrodden people, then they began to turn their attention to other concerns, particularly those who would have been inclined to be thinkers in the first place. Catholic philosophy might have been one of the areas that would have solved the problem of trying to get this integrating principle that Catholics were looking for. This happened to be a period of time in the 1930s in philosophical circles where you had a tremendous revival of Thomistic philosophy, the philosophy of St. Thomas Aquinas. But Catholic philosophy, though it was very strong, soon came to be superseded in the mid and late 30s by a tremendous growth in Catholic social doctrine. And Catholic social doctrine was based primarily on the doctrine of the mystical body of Christ, as that doctrine had been developed in the letters of St. Paul. A man by the name of Carl P. Hensler, who was one of the founders of the so-called Catholic Radical Alliance, based in Pittsburgh, described Catholic social doctrine and its implementation in American life in the 1930s in this way, and we quote him. The mystical body of Christ, Hensler wrote, as studied in the corporate worship of the church, is a living system of social sanctification. May it be the dynamic that will hasten the solution of the natural antagonism between the individual and society. In other words, what Hensler was saying is that by studying the social doctrine of the church, we would be able to come up with a good number of solutions, many answers to America's social ills. In 1929, a speech had been given to the National Catholic Education Association by a young professor of philosophy at Catholic University named Monsignor Fulton J. Sheen. Sheen called for the education of the American Catholic people so that we might experience a Catholic Renaissance in the United States. Now, what did he mean by a Catholic Renaissance? Well, first of all, Monsignor Sheen felt that Catholicism represented a very, very coherent system that was solidly grounded in reason. It was a system that would perfectly meet the needs of modern society and the spiritual longings of all humanity. And you find, therefore, a tremendous emphasis, especially now as we go through the decade of the 1930s, you find a tremendous emphasis on Catholic college campuses to not only teach Catholic doctrine, to not only inculcate the principles of Catholicism, of Catholic theology, but to try to get the point across to Catholic undergraduates that their Catholic faith and their Catholic education was an all-encompassing sort of thing. That Catholicism was not simply something to be studied in the classroom. Catholicism was indeed a way of life to be lived. And if we lived our life according to the principles of our faith, we could indeed change society. George Bull was a famed Jesuit thinker from Fordham University. And he had no interest in what he saw as the, quotes, impossible task of being Catholic in creed and anti-Catholic in culture. In other words, forgetting your Catholicism when you went out into the modern culture. Father Bull went on to write a book on the subject and to develop exactly what he meant by it. The rather well-known editor of Commonweal magazine in those days, a man named George N. Schuster, who was a very, very liberal Catholic by the standards of the 1930s, wrote an article on this kind of a theme, and he decried very much any kind of a Catholicism which clenches its fists against beauty and mystical insight while giving too much concentration to numbers, to moralism, and to apologetics. Close quotes. You can see how very liberal George Schuster was even by the norms of the 1930s. Even some of the traditional approaches to Catholicism on Catholic campuses were being challenged in the 1930s. For example, you had the concept on most Catholic campuses of the spiritual director, you know, the one who oversaw the spiritual life of the Catholic undergraduates living on campus. At the University of Notre Dame in the early 30s, the spiritual director was Father John O'Hara of the Holy Cross Fathers. Father O'Hara was a very traditional, very disciplined Holy Cross Father who provided a wide schedule of masses and devotional exercises for the undergraduates on campus, advocated frequent reception of the Sacrament of Penance, frequent reception of Holy Communion, and so forth. And he was very, very strict in his interpretation of how Catholic life should be lived by undergraduates while they were on the Notre Dame campus. Well, an interesting event occurred. This George Schuster, who was the editor of Commonweal, in the early 30s was serving as a professor of English literature at the University of Notre Dame. And on one occasion, George Schuster placed a copy of a book on the library shelf at Notre Dame. The book was called The Rainbow, and it was a book that had been written some years earlier by D.H. Lawrence. Now, most professors would probably not have put that on a library shelf on a Catholic campus in the 1930s because The Rainbow was considered to be a somewhat controversial book. Father O'Hara got wind of the fact that it had been placed on the bookshelf, and no sooner had he got wind of it than he made sure that D.H. Lawrence's book was removed. Very interesting kind of thing to have happened, to say the least. In seminaries and theological faculties, the mood was also one of change in the 1930s. For example, there was a young professor of theology at Woodstock College in Maryland by the name of Father John Courtney Murray. Courtney Murray was developing in the early 30s a course for seminarians studying at Woodstock in which he would emphasize the fact that seminarians should be taught what he called the livability of the Word of God. A very novel kind of a concept. You went out and lived that which you were taught. Then, on the more practical everyday level, getting away from some of this intellectual theorizing, on the more practical everyday level, you had a man like Jesuit Father Daniel Lord, who was the editor of the Queen's work in the early 1930s. Father Lord did tremendous work in his day. In 1931, he began the so-called Summer Schools of Catholic Action. These were for young people primarily, and they offered thousands of young people in our country intensive weeks of prayer, of liturgical participation, of lectures, and of social life. And I suppose, too, Father Daniel Lord was well remembered for his work with the Catholic Students' Mission Crusade, more affectionately called the CSMC. Many of us in our days in grade school and high school remember the CSMC, and I suspect we might remember that song that Father Daniel Lord composed. An army of youth flying the standard of truth, we're fighting for Christ the Lord. Heads lifted high, Catholic action our cry, and the cross our only sword. That song was sung by many, many generations of Catholic grade school and high school students who belonged in a formal way to the CSMC. There was in these years also in the mind of many people a similarity between the policies of the Roosevelt administration and the tenets of Catholic social doctrine as they had been articulated by Pope Leo XIII in Rerum Novarum and 40 years later by Pope Pius XI in his famous encyclical Quadragesimo Anno. Cardinal George Mundelein of Chicago was so thrilled about the fact that President Roosevelt had developed many of these points of Catholic social doctrine that he said very clearly and very unambiguously that the Roosevelt administration was giving more friendly sympathy to the church and its institutions than any administration in the White House in half a century. Now, what you can gather from that is that Cardinal Mundelein was a strong, strong partisan of FDR. Another Catholic lay organization in the 30s that Roosevelt would have favored to a certain degree, although it may have gone a bit more to the left even than Roosevelt was, would be the Catholic worker movement that was begun by the very famous Catholic convert Dorothy Day and her friend Peter Maurin. Dorothy Day had been a suffragette. She had been involved in the International Workers of the World, and she met Peter Maurin. The two of them came together in New York City in the early 30s, and they founded the Catholic Worker Movement with its very famous publication, The Catholic Worker. The Catholic Worker was known for its so-called, quote, easy essays that were written by Peter Maurin. And what the Catholic Worker newspaper was calling for, what the movement was calling for, was a transformation in the person. A transformation in which I stopped thinking about I, and I started thinking about they. I stopped thinking about my own needs, and I started considering the needs of others. Rather interestingly, in the career of Dorothy Day, just in the last few weeks, John Cardinal O'Connor of New York announced that he was going to gather people together who were acquainted with the life and the career of Dorothy Day, and consider the possibility of initiating her cause for canonization. Very interestingly, Cardinal O'Connor noted that despite Dorothy Day's social radicalism, her respect for and her commitment and obedience to church teaching were unswerving all of her life. What an interesting commentary then on Dorothy Day. Franklin Roosevelt did, in his administration, have a rapport with Roman Catholics. He was a consummate politician. He knew he had the Catholic vote, and therefore he wanted to reward Catholics. He put people like Jim Farley and Tom Walsh into his administration. Frank Murphy, the governor of Michigan, who would occupy a seat on the Supreme Court, he made governor general of the Philippines. During the course of the Roosevelt administration, probably one quarter of the judicial appointments which were made were appointments that were given to Roman Catholics. Now, not every Catholic in the country was favorable to FDR by any means. Many people, for example, Governor Al Smith and other prominent Catholics, felt that at least as the New Deal was going on, Roosevelt was becoming too liberal, he was becoming too radical, he was getting away from that which he had originally intended when the country elected him in 1932. And as a result, many Catholics became quite conservative and quite anti-Roosevelt. I suppose one of the classic cases of a Catholic who was very, very anti-Roosevelt, in fact, maybe the leading anti-Roosevelt Catholic in the country, would come in the person of Charles Edward Coughlin. And so it is to the career of Father Coughlin that we must turn and speak at some length. Charles Edward Coughlin was born in Hamilton, Ontario, Canada. He was ordained a priest, a member of the Bazilian Fathers in Canada. remained with them just a very short time, and then he decided that he would move from Canada to Detroit, Michigan, where he became rather quickly incarnated in the Archdiocese of Detroit. He was not in the Archdiocese of Detroit terribly long when he was assigned to become pastor of the Shrine of the Little Flower, which is located, if you're in downtown Detroit, you just go right down Woodward Avenue a few miles, and it is down Woodward Avenue in the town of Royal Oak, Michigan. Now, when Father Coughlin arrived at the Shrine of the Little Flower in Royal Oak, he arrived at a parish that was not in terribly, terribly good shape, and he knew that if he were left there long enough, he would ultimately be charged with building a new church. So Father Coughlin began to become very active in the community of Royal Oak, and one of the first things he did was to go on radio. His early radio programs were catechetical instructions for children. And he was doing very well. He was very well received, and he was becoming very popular, and his radio programs were well liked. And as time went on, he began to move away from simply catechetical instructions to children, and he began to become far more political. He began to try to take the themes of social life and apply them to the themes of Catholic social doctrine, rather, and apply them to one's social life. And on he went. Well, as he was getting more political, he was gathering more people around him who thought the way he did. And finally, he had so many people gathered around him, and so many people listening to his radio show, that he said, well, perhaps we should begin an organization. And he did begin an organization which he called the National Union for Social Justice. And in the early stages of this National Union of Social Justice, Father Coughlin was saying, it's Roosevelt or ruin. If we do not have Roosevelt, the country is going to go down the tubes. But that was going to change very, very quickly. The National Union for Social Justice in 1936 began publishing a newspaper called Social Justice. You could purchase Social Justice for 10 cents at the back of almost every Catholic church in the country, and certainly on all of the newsstands. As Father Coughlin began to write extensively and to get others to write extensively for him, he began to get contributions from people from all over the country, people who really believed in what he was saying and what he was teaching. Economically, he said Franklin Roosevelt is moving too far to the left, and if it was Roosevelt or ruin in the early days, by the time we get into the late 30s, it is Roosevelt and ruin. So he felt Roosevelt had moved too far to the left economically, he thought Roosevelt was too far to the right economically. Father Coughlin wanted to go a little more to the left. But he thought that on foreign policy, Franklin D. Roosevelt was too far to the left, and it was time to move right. He was referring to Roosevelt in the most abject terms, and he had become a strong enemy. Well, as we say, all these political contributions were pouring into Royal Oak, Michigan, and with them, Father Coughlin was able to build a magnificent new shrine of the Little Flower and a tower next to the shrine, and at the top of that tower was Father Coughlin's office, and Father Coughlin would broadcast to the nation. Every Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock he began, and he had a melodious speaking voice, "Good afternoon, my friends," and then he would go on for a half an hour, usually decrying the Roosevelt administration. So, he was an enormously powerful man. People all over the country were listening to him, and the National Union for Social Justice became so strong that in 1936 they actually ran their own candidate for President of the United States in the person of North Dakota Congressman William Lemke. Initially, when Father Coughlin began his crusade, the Bishop of Detroit, Michael Gallagher, was very much in favor of what he was trying to do. But as the years went on, as Bishop Gallagher passed from the scene and he was succeeded by Cardinal Edward Mooney, the Roosevelt administration decided that they better put pressure on Cardinal Mooney to try to silence Father Coughlin. So, the Cardinal, on pressure from the Roosevelt administration, told Father Coughlin that he had to cease and desist in his radio broadcasts. And do you know something? Father Coughlin immediately obeyed the directive of the Archbishop of Detroit, Cardinal Mooney. He said it is the priest's place, first, foremost, and always, to obey his bishop. And he immediately ceased and desisted. There was not one more radio broadcast. He was an obedient priest, and he deserves much, much credit for that. Then, some years later, the government decided they were going to deprive the publication Social Justice of its postage rates, and prices became so astronomical to try to mail Social Justice all over the country, if not all over the world, that in fact Social Justice had to go out of business as well. There was a national poll taken among Catholics, Protestants, and Jewish people, and the national poll, the percentages that came up in that national poll were to the effect of, well, how do you like Father Coughlin? Do you support him? Do you agree with him? And so forth. And the results of that national poll were indeed very interesting. The breakdown is indeed very interesting. The verdict is going to be out on Father Coughlin for a number of years, but there's no question he stirred up tremendous controversy. You either loved the man or you hated him. This was also the era of World War II. Catholics went and fought in much, much larger numbers than they had in the First World War. President Roosevelt realized the tremendous Catholic contribution in all the three theaters of war during World War II. Because he realized it, in 1939, on Christmas Eve, President Roosevelt sent a telegraph to the Vatican, to Pope Pius XII, and Roosevelt said this, quotes, "It would give me great satisfaction to send you my personal representative in order that our parallel endeavors for peace and the alleviation of suffering may be assisted." And that is exactly what happened. Early in 1940, Myron C. Taylor was appointed. Myron C. Taylor, a non-Catholic, a retired gentleman who had been president of U.S. Steel for many years. For 10 years, Myron Taylor was President Roosevelt's personal representative at the Vatican. Taylor would visit the Vatican periodically, and for about 4, or no more than 5, of those 10 years, Taylor's chief assistant, a man by the name of Harold H. Tittman, actually lived in Vatican City. He, Mr. Tittman, had the formal diplomatic rank of chargé d'affaires. Myron Taylor was never paid for this mission, and any of the expenses which were incurred came from a separate White House or a private White House fund, I suspect we would have to say. Taylor never received the rank of ambassador. He simply was what we would call an ambassador for social purposes. His nomination, that is to say, a formal nomination of Myron Taylor to be United States Ambassador to the Vatican, was never submitted by President Roosevelt. Although we can say that with minor differences, Myron Taylor was treated in pretty much the same way that any formal ambassador to the Vatican would be treated. Well, why was it that FDR would never formally submit the nomination of Myron C. Taylor to be Ambassador to the Vatican? The reason was primarily that Roosevelt was very concerned, while he was very friendly to Catholics, while he was very amenable to Catholics, while Catholics contributed a great deal to his administration, while Catholics did contribute a tremendously substantial amount in the war effort in Europe, in the Pacific, in North Africa, while Catholics got all kinds of judicial appointments, senators and governors and so forth abounded during the 30s and 40s, senators and governors who were Roman Catholics. The presence was so strong, but Roosevelt still hesitated. It might be the 1930s, the late 30s, it might be the early 40s, but there was still a great deal of anti-Catholic hostility in the country. That's what Roosevelt was afraid of, and that's why he never submitted formally the name of Myron Taylor to be United States Ambassador. It was not until the administration of President Ronald Reagan that we did get finally a formal United States ambassador to the Vatican. The first ambassador was a man by the name of William Wilson. William Wilson was a California businessman, a close personal friend of Ronald Reagan, the first ambassador to the Vatican, and he was confirmed overwhelmingly as U.S. ambassador with only a very, very minor outburst, if you will, if we can even call it an outburst, only minor criticism on the part of non-Catholics around the world for what this would mean. So this was the era then, the 30s, the 40s, the era of the New Deal, the era of the Second World War, the era in which Franklin Roosevelt was the all-pervasive political figure. Catholics certainly contributed, certainly came into their own. They were as domesticated, they were as sophisticated, they were as much part of the American scene as was anybody else in the country. They were ready to move into the 50s, they were ready to move into the genuinely modern, if we may call it that, era of the 20th century and take their own. That is the period of time we shall take up in our next consideration as we look at the role of the Catholic Church in the era of the 1950s. Thank you.